Global exports, global trade in ethanol has become a significant component of the U.S. Ethanol industry's business mix, as well as its strategy for the future. And I can tell you that I take personal pleasure in this, being that I'm have been since 2008 the staff member at RFA responsible for this issue. I can tell you that it's good to see that this issue is no longer the redheaded stepchild of the National Ethanol Conference. We are at the forefront and a preeminent part of this industry, and it's something that this industry should be very proud about. Over the last 5 years, it's been the strong growth in exports that has helped this industry weather and survive our infrastructure limitations at home. But it's also this strong ethanol export part of our mix that's allowed us to maintain our competitiveness. It's allowed us to continue to grow in the face of difficulties, as well as to remain competitive overseas and around the globe. I want to very briefly talk about some of the issues that can set the stage for our phenomenal panel today. But as you can see from the graph here, our 2014 numbers for ethanol exports are significant. We exported 836 million gallons. This represents the second largest export volume on record, and a significant 35% increase since last year, 2013. We've asked, as our chairman indicated a little earlier, we're exporting to 51 countries, all six of the inhabited continents, and I can tell you, if penguins start to drive, I'm going to try to work on them too. We also see a significant growth in what exports represent for the share of business for each company. For our industry, it represents just short of 6% of our business, which is significant and also a significant growth over previous years. This has brought valuable dollars back home to our companies. Last year represented $2.1 billion worth of exports. Certainly that's improved our company's bottom line and helped improve our overall stability as an industry. But while the success over the last several years has been record-breaking, there's still room for growth. And as long as ethanol, U.S.-made ethanol, provides a valuable, cheaper, and cleaner alternative to petroleum-based gasoline and other carcinogenic or toxic fuel additives, it'll continue to be sought around the globe. So our goal with this panel is to help you identify some opportunities, maybe new opportunities for you, or expand existing opportunities in the area of trade, and help address some of the challenges that we face as we move forward. So very briefly, I want to briefly introduce you to our panelists. Our first panelist is Pedro Pereños. Pedro Pereños is with Eco Energy, Vice President for International, and newly minted in that position. Thank you. Our next panelist, and I'm not going to go in that order, is Jim Galvin, who's the CEO and Director of Lakeview Energy. He's going to be able to give a perspective as being a producer who is actively involved in the area of trade, is very actively involved in export promotions through our efforts as well as their own efforts. Our next panelist is Henrique Pacini, the Economic Affairs Officer for the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, who authored a phenomenal report on trade and the status and the elements with respect to trade over currently. And our next panelist, Michael Dwyer, is Director of Global Policy Analysis with U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Ag Service. He'll be able to give you an indication of some of the resources that are available to you, talk a little bit about what the U.S. government is doing to help our industry promote our product overseas. And then our last panelist is Robert Wright, the newly minted Secretary General of our European counterpart, ePure. Without further ado, I'd like to bring up our first panelist, Pedro Paranos. Just so you know, Pedro serves as Vice President of International for Eco-Energy, leading marketer of ethanol, which includes United States, Brazil, Europe, and Asia. He's worked with Copersucar as executive manager for 5 years, managing the ethanol division. Prior to joining Copersucar, Mr. Paranos worked for 10 years in the oil industry in Brazil in a variety of supply, trading, and logistics positions. He holds a degree in business administration and marketing. Mr. Paranos, thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to be in a panel with that high level with Jim and Hickey, Mike, and Robert. So, you know, I'm glad to be here sharing this panel with you. So today I'm going to talk about the global ethanol market. Before starting, though, let me give one slide introduction of our company. So EcoEnergy is a midstream company centered on marketing, trading, and logistics of ethanol in the U.S. We have 14% of U.S. Total share and 25% of the export share out of the U.S. Copersucar, our partner in Brazil, is the largest Brazilian marketer of ethanol and sugar. Together, the two companies account for around 13% of the global market, and with revenues of in excess of $8 billion only from biofuels alone. So moving forward, let me start giving you some of the global production and demand picture, and with this, some details about Brazil and U.S. So this is the global production landscape today using 2014 numbers. So a total production in the globe was 29 billion gallons, 111 million cubes. So this production, you know, starting from the left, you know, U.S. Has 14.8 billion gallons of production, 13.9 of demand. Brazil, 7.4 production, 7.3 billion gallons of demand. And then Europe, 2.2 with 2.4 of demand. And then you have Thailand and China pretty much balanced, you know, if you consider only the fuel. China produces 740 million gallons of ethanol, which is their fuel demand as well. Thailand, 350 production and demand. And then you have three countries that have imbalances, which are the most important ones are Japan and Korea. You know, that's industrial grade and ETBE usage. So those countries together, they have a demand of 430 million gallons with a production of 70. So that creates a natural short of 350 million gallons per year. Philippines has a production of 60 million gallons with a demand of 120. So that creates a short of 60 to 70 million gallons per year. And then Pakistan is a structural long with 140 million gallons of production and virtually no domestic demand. And then you have other countries with 3.5 billion gallons of production and 3.6 of demand. So that's the global picture today. If you see U.S. and Brazil together, they account for 75% of both production and demand in the world. So that leads me to the next slide. So let's dig in on those two countries to see the outlook for this year in those two countries. So the top chart, you have the sugarcane crush in the center-south of Brazil, the green bars, in the last 10 years. So you see that the sugarcane crush has dramatically increased from the crop 05-06 to the crop 10-11. So we had a small problem, weather-related, in the crop 11-12 that reduced the sugarcane crush. And then in the last 3 years, it kind of the sugarcane crush has reached a plateau. Right, the plateau at around slightly below 600 million tons of cane. So the dotted line is our forecast for the crop 15-16 with 580 million tons of cane. And given the current environment, it's hard to believe that that's going much higher than that in the foreseeable future. So that's sugarcane crush. In the bottom chart, you have ethanol production in the last 10 years as well, right? The light blue bar on the bottom is the anhydrous production, and the bar on the top, the dark blue, is the hydrous production. As you know, the hydrous is used directly into the flex fuel fleet in Brazil, and the anhydrous is blended currently at 25% on the gasoline. It's our E25. So it's interesting to see that all this huge growth in the last 10 years in the beginning of this period, it happened mainly on the hydros. So you see the anhydrous pretty much stable at around 2 billion gallons per year of production, while the hydros demand has increased. Now that started to change in the last 3 years. You see, you know, anhydrous starting to pick up. And it's important to understand that all this hydrous, this 3.9 billion gallons of hydrous production we forecast for the next crop, that's a big cushion that in case the anhydrous demand increases, Brazil can always go there and use this hydrous, produce more anhydrous instead. You know, so any increase in production in demand in Brazil doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the direct exports from the U.S. because they have all this hydrous cushion that could be absorbed when you produce more anhydrous. So three things to conclude from this slide. The first one is production in Brazil is stable or stagnant, if you will. So no growth is expected in the coming years, and there's no new investments in the pipeline. So that sugarcane crush should remain pretty much stable. The second one, the demand is growing, right? The fuel demand is growing. So we have a fleet growth projected at an average compound growth rate at 4% per year, at least in the next 20 years, while it's lower than the last 10 years, which was 6% per year, it's still a significant growth. So fuel demand is growing. And you have two incentives now for ethanol. One is the tax, the CD tax, federal tax reinstated in the gasoline. That's 30% new tax on the gasoline. It's a big amount. And on 20 cents per gallon of diesel, and the blend increase, which should have happened in Feb 15th, but it should happen by the end of this month. It's still lacking presidential approval, and it should move the blend from 25% to 27%. So, you know, so the outlook for Brazil, although that doesn't necessarily translate into exports, directly translate into exports from the U.S. to Brazil, the opportunity in the coming years is big, because as they grow the anhydrous demand, as they have more of the product that the U.S. exports to, the imbalances, you know, and the seasonality in Brazil could trigger more exports, not only to the northeast of Brazil, but also to the center-south, right? Although that's not the base case this year. So moving on, let's take a closer look into the U.S. So that's the top chart is the U.S. domestic production in billion gallons in the last 7 years. So the dotted line, 2015, we expect production this year is going to be 14.8 billion gallons, roughly. So production has been increasing. In the bottom chart, you have U.S. exports in billion gallons. So for this year, we forecast 800 million gallons, and I'm going to give more details on this number in a little bit. So three things to consider here when we look into the details of the U.S. S&D. One, there's an excess of production capacity. Production capacity is around 15 billion gallons per year. You know, and it's still growing marginally, but still growing. You have, as everyone knows, the domestic blend wall with 13.5 billion gallons of demand. And so the domestic growth is pretty much dependent on the gasoline demand and on the regulation to remove this blend wall. And then the exports, they are very important, but they are not enough to solve for the balance sheet this year. We still believe, you know, they can help to solve for the balance sheet, but the production, excess of production capacity is more than what the export market could absorb, especially this year. So now taking a close look on the export market by market and on the competitiveness of ethanol. So this slide, this chart shows the U.S. and Brazil exports relative to each other, basis 100%. So the blue bar is U.S. total exports, and the green bar is Brazil total exports. So you see the tremendous change that has happened in the last 6 years. You know, in 2008, U.S. had only 10% of the total of Brazil plus U.S. exports sum. And this number has changed from 10% to 70% of this total export last year. So the U.S. has already taken over, you know, pretty much all the markets that Brazil was exporting, except two markets that I'm going to share in this next slide. So here you see by destination, the red balloons are the markets to which the U.S. exports, and the blue balloons the markets to which Brazil exports. So you see that Brazil now has only South Korea and Japan, which are the two markets with a quality restriction. So it has to be sugarcane, you know, and they have some controls on the quality because it's for industry usage and also for the ETB, that this number is still inside. And then the U.S. has all the other markets, right? So that shift has already happened, you know, when we look into the 14 number. And the countries to which Brazil export, those are very unlikely that they will shift, at least shift heavily towards the U.S. just because there's a feedstock or quality restrictions. So now analyzing the competitiveness, what has changed with this crude price changes. In the top chart, you have in the green line, the MTBE prices in the United Arab Emirates. And then the blue line, you have the U.S. ethanol delivered in that market as well. You know, and that represents well the Arabian Gulf blending economics. In the bottom chart, you already have the spread, so that's the difference between one line and the other. So whenever this bottom chart is positive, it means that there's a blending incentive for ethanol, you know, favoring ethanol. Whenever this bar on the bottom is negative, it means that MTBE is the most economic component. So you see the red circle showing that that's as of until the end of January. So if you see that since this crude prices drop, although the ethanol dropped together, you know, the economics are negative. So that's a big change if you look in the last at least 2 years. That is a significant change from what we had before. So three takeaways on this blending economics. We should expect less demand this year given that, you know, negative period, you know, and that should remain. The purchase will be more on the spot, so there's no agreement for the entire year to supply that market, and the crude is the main driver. Now that doesn't mean that the demand is going to be zero in our base case, as I'm going to show in a little bit, because the future gasoline curve is a little bit better, so the economics in the future are better than the current economics. So there will be some opportunities, we believe, but they are not, you know, a no-brainer as they were in 2014. And then the second interesting thing to share about the ethanol competitiveness, this chart, we compare Brazil, Europe, and U.S. FOB prices. So when those three countries or regions export to the rest of the world, the green line, you have Brazil FOB prices. And in this scenario, I'm already stretching a little bit the exchange rate. I'm considering an exchange rate real to the dollar 3, so 3 reais to $1, which is slightly higher than the 2.85 that we have today. So you see the minimum prices stretching the exchange rate that we believe Brazil could make for the export market is around $210 per gallon FOB Santos, Brazil. The second one is a purple line is Europe. So Europe, considering January, the January future curve, would be around $190 per gallon FOB Rotterdam. And then you have the U.S., which is the most competitive, at around $170 per gallon FOB the Gulf Coast. So the red bar is U.S. minus Europe. So U.S. is at least 20 cents per gallon more competitive than the second cheapest, which is Europe. And we all know, you know, the supply in Europe is limited. So any big export out of Europe would make prices there adjust. So this slide clearly showed that the U.S. is the most competitive molecule to export to the rest of the world, and it's at least 20 cents better than the second best. So that brings a tremendous advantage. So all the existing exports should remain coming from the U.S. except those two markets I mentioned, Korea and Japan. One thing could change here, I'm going to mention again, but it's important to highlight, is the exchange rate, right? Especially with the euro. So this comparison here in dollar considers 115 dollars for 1 euro. If that exchange rate goes to parity one by one, that means Europe will be at parity with the U.S. So European prices would come off to the $170 per gallon at the U.S. level. Now here I'm just to share with you our base case. You know, that's our opinion. It's one opinion. You know, it doesn't mean it's the right one. It's just one opinion to share with you. If you look into the pie, we can split the demand of U.S. exports into three categories. The first one that we call the mandated markets. So mandated markets such as Canada, such as Philippines, or such as the northeast of Brazil, represent 64% of the U.S. exports. So in our base case, that will remain or even be increased, right? The second layer of demand is what we call in here the medium-low risk. That's industrial usage, European destinations, and some other destinations such as India. That accounts for 25% of U.S. exports. And then the third category is what we call high risk. They are very price sensitive, and the octane blending is the most relevant of this category. And that accounts for 11% of U.S. export. So if we start from the 2014 export base, you know, and this is rounded numbers to facilitate the understanding, 2014 exports were 840 million gallons. So in our base case, what we have is that those mandated markets, they will have a slight increase of 35 million gallons more, but some other markets will decrease. The medium low risk will decrease 20 million gallons, and the octane blending will decrease 55 million gallons. So when we consider all that, it means that our base case for exports in 15 is 800 million gallons out of the U.S. Now, we have a low case, you know, if crude prices drop further, you know, if India doesn't take, or if the octane blending reduction is even stronger than what I thought, it could be as low as 700 million gallons, and in a high case, it could be 900 million gallons. Now, to finish, let me just give some additional factors to consider here when looking into the U.S. export potential. Some things could happen that will boost exports. So Brazil's center-south sugarcane crop, if they have a bad year because of the weather, that could mean more export out of the U.S. If global sugar prices recover, you know, and reaches around 18 cents per pound, that could shift production mix towards sugar in Brazil. So that means less ethanol production, more potential exports out of the U.S. to Brazil. And corn and wheat prices, if those feedstocks remain competitive relatively to crude, you know, we could have a cheap octane to supply to the world. And some other factors could mean less exports. The exchange rate, as I mentioned, you know, if dollars keeps appreciating compared to euro, especially euro and real, that could mean less exports. Crude and fuel prices, lower prices mean less exports. U.S. railroad logistics could send prices high in the U.S., and that means less exports. A stronger gasoline demand in the U.S. in general is good, but it could mean less exports. And then U.S. ethanol production, if there's any rationalization of the supply, it could change the U.S. Domestic S&D, and that could translate into less exports. And with that, I finish. Thank you all.
Thank you, Pedro. Our next panelist is Jim Galvin, CEO and Director of Lakeview Energy, a biofuels manufacturing, commodities trading, agribusiness, and wind energy company based in Chicago. He has over 15 years of international experience in developing renewable energy businesses across Europe and the U.S. Mr. Galvin currently holds a number of directorships in companies, including two biorefineries, Three Rivers Energy in Ohio, and Plymouth Energy in Iowa, and is a member of the U.S. Grains Council Ethanol Advisory Team. Without further ado, Jim Galvin.
Thank you very much, Ed, for the introduction, and thanks for the opportunity to speak here this morning. I think in speaking to some of my fellow panelists here, there seems to be a kind of a strong Irish theme. So I'm kind of wondering, are we here for our ability to consume alcohol or whether it is our ability to produce it? But for the purposes of this presentation, we'll stick to the production side of it. I suppose what I wanted to kind of give people a perspective on here is very much a producer's perspective. because I feel very strongly that there has to be a very active participation and a very active involvement of producers in helping to develop the export market and the potential that's out there with the export market. Just to give you, I suppose, a bit of a quick background on Lakeview Energy, who are we? We're a producer of over 115 million gallons of ethanol through our ownership in biorefineries in Plymouth Energy in Iowa and in Three Rivers Energy in Ohio. We also operate a trading business, Lakeview Trading, so that's based out of our head office in Chicago. And we also have a base here in Texas, in Houston. And we market our own ethanol from both plants. And we also market some ethanol for third-party producers. I suppose to give you a kind of a background on what we have done, I suppose, over the last number of years in terms of trying to develop that export market. We have, I suppose, undertaken significant investment in the company in recent years in trying to work on facilitating that export business. We have tank storage options here in Texas City. You know, we have a rail car fleet across both plants of over 250 rail cars, which is obviously logistics is a critical play here. And of equal importance, we have the whole regulatory compliance side of it that enables us to do business not alone within the US, but also internationally across different countries. In terms of the actual biorefineries, again, I think over the last number of years, we have made a lot of both, I think, capital investments and human capital investments. In terms of trying to improve ourselves to be the most efficient in what we're doing. You know, I mean, if you're looking at it from our point of view at the plants, you know, the specifications we make differ across different markets. So if we're looking at the Canadian spec or the Brazilian spec or the EU spec, they're all different specs that we make. So we need to ensure at the plant level, you know, that we have the flexibility to be able to produce those different specifications, but equally that we're doing it, I think, as efficiently as possible. And, you know, I mean, we've made investments in things like mold sieve capacity improvements, and these are all very important because at the end of the day, you know, we have to make sure we're getting the best return for the products that we produce at plant level. Equally, we've made a lot of investment into the whole regulatory and sustainability criteria. And I think three significant things that we have done and that any plant needs to do to be able to take advantage of the export market. We have a DSP license that we've put in place that allows us to market undenatured ethanol. And that's obviously important when you look at the figures that were presented here earlier in terms of the likes of the Brazilian market, the ability to be able to produce and sell undenatured. We also have spent an awful lot of time on developing the whole sustainability certification. And when we went into the EU market originally, obtaining ISCC compliance was a big part of our business plan in Plymouth Energy. And, you know, I think that sometimes we underestimate, I think, you know, how, I suppose, efficient we are as an industry in terms of the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look at the certification that we have in Plymouth Energy, we have a 47% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, and that is certified. And that allows us to trade our product across different countries. And I, as I said, I mean, that is a significant thing for any plant to be able to achieve in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And look, that has taken a long time to put that in place. You know, I always say that we're not in a sprint, we're in a marathon in terms of developing these markets. They don't happen overnight, but they evolve over time, but you have to stick with it. You know, in doing that, you know, that has involved us getting our suppliers of corn involved. So we have to go inside the farm gate. We have to continuously audit this on an annual basis. So we're basically tracking from the farm right through our destination. And everything in terms of energy use is being tracked right through to the end line. But it certainly is a very significant thing to have, that you need to have, obviously, for the export business. And equally, in terms of carbon intensity compliance, we have to have that in place for whatever markets that we're participating in. And again, you can ask the question, why? Why are we doing all this? And I think that there's advantages that we see at the plant level, but I think equally that there's a lot of advantages across the industry level. You know, I mean, from our point of view, it obviously offers us access to new markets across the globe for our products. It most importantly, it facilitates growth and expansion opportunities for our industry. So if we have a situation where we're exporting product, one of the big things here is that we're helping to maintain the supply-demand balance. And you saw the figures from Pedro earlier in terms of our ability to produce versus what's domestically consumed and how important the export market is. And we see that. We see that very much at both our plants in Plymouth Energy and Three Rivers, how important it is to have that export market. So it's not alone, I think, for the plants individually, but it's equally for the industry, and that's why we have to have that kind of a collective approach to developing this market. Equally, obviously, from the point of view of shareholders, we always ask ourselves at our board meetings, is this the best return that we can get for our shareholders? And, you know, we have seen over the last number of years that certainly it helps to enhance returns for shareholders. Again, if you look at the progress we've made to date on this, at Plymouth Energy, we've probably averaged 60% of our production has been exported over the last 3 years in Plymouth Energy. That is a significant part of our production, and that can vary, you know, from as low as maybe 40% to up to 100%, depending on where the market is. But again, it's a new market. It's a different market that we have. It's a different option that we have as to where we can sell our product into. In Three Rivers in Ohio, we're just commencing that process of exporting in 2015. So we're looking at New York Harbor. We're looking at Canada. We have the rail fleet in place to do that. And that's something that we feel strongly about in terms of developing that market out of where we're located in Ohio. In terms of what we're doing at the trading, Lakeview trading level, you know, we're continuing to develop closer relations and closer links with international customers because we want to get as close to our end user as we possibly can, and we want to know what they want. So we're continuously pushing the boat out in terms of looking at forging closer links internationally in terms of developing our market. And, you know, I mean, if you look at it, I think we're very proud of the fact, particularly in Plymouth Energy, where, you know, we're using corn that's locally grown, and we're exporting our product to, and have exported our product to Canada, to Brazil, to the EU, to Peru, to the Philippines, India, Middle East. And that's a fantastic success story in itself, you know, to be able to produce product that can compete across the global stage as effectively as we can. In terms of the challenges we see, I think there are two key challenges. We've got political challenges that are out there, and we've got an educational exercise that we continuously need to work on. And certainly from my experience of partaking in the trade missions last year to China and to Japan and South Korea, I think as a producer, it's critically important, I think, that we participate in these trade missions because we all know that they can be a pain in the backside to fit in, but it's critically important. When you get out there and you see what the market demands, I think as a producer, it's critically important we know what's going on there. And certainly, you know, you look at the political challenges that are out there, you look at the trade negotiations. We need to make sure that biofuels are a central part of that. I think Bob this morning in his opening address referred to the USTR, and we have, you know, Rob right here that's speaking later. I think that, you know, when you look at the EU market and you look at Pedro's earlier slides there, I mean, that has been a critical market for us in the last number of years, and we need to get that reopened. And we know that it's critically important that we get very active in opening markets like that. In terms of global policy on biofuels, during our trade mission to Japan, one of the things that struck me very forcibly was the policy that they have in place where they will not accept imports of ethanol that don't have a greater than 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And in effect, the only ethanol that they can import directly into Japan is Brazilian ethanol. So when you look at that and you look at the educational side of it, it's critically important that we update, I think, you know, different people across the globe. The U.S. global network we have is fantastic out there. You know, you have the USDA, you have FOSS, you have the embassies. But these people need to get more of our time in terms of spreading the story and updating them as to where we are in our industry here, because we have advanced a lot in the last number of years, but people across the globe are not fully up to speed, and that's a big part of the job we need to do. Just get the facts and get the information out there in terms of what we're capable of. The same in terms of you know, the national government policies. A lot of it is outdated. You know, you go to China, they talk about food versus fuel, still out there. That's outdated information. Again, in the likes of Japan, you see outdated information. So we need to get the message out there from our industry's point of view more and more, and use all the avenues we can to spread that word globally. I suppose in terms of my take on these things, I certainly believe, you know, that global exports can double in the next 3 to 5 years. There's no question about that. I think we do underestimate, and again, it's when you get out there, you know, to and participate in the likes of these trade missions, you do realise that we do underestimate the value of what we're producing here. We definitely underestimate it. I mean, we need to continuously remind ourselves, as well as everyone else, you know, that we do produce the cheapest octane out there. We are a big part of the solution in terms of reducing air pollution, and that's none more so obvious when you look at China. I remember one morning looking out of my hotel room and to see the smog in Singapore, and we are a big part of that kind of a solution. We can offer them solutions on that. We certainly are the solution to increasing fuel efficiency. I think that's proven. And obviously, we are play a big part in reducing the cost of our motor fuel. And we can do that not alone here in the US, but across the globe. And I think there are things that we really need to focus on. And I think that if there's one thing that I would say is that certainly a rising tide lifts all boats. There's no doubt about that. And we do, we talk about an all-of-the-above energy policy, but we as an industry need an all-of-the-above approach to ensuring that we get the message out there. You know, we need government, we need the trade associations, we need producers, we need the traders, transport and logistics. We all need to work together to ensure that we can achieve, I think, what's obtainable out there in terms of the export potential. And again, you know, I want to reiterate that point, that it's so important as part of the mix to help us grow, continue to grow and develop as an industry, having that sustainable export market out there. So with that, Ed, I'll finish it up. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Jim. We'll move along, try to keep us on time. Our next panelist, Henrique Puccini, is an economic affairs officer at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, where he's responsible for international bioenergy and organic agriculture projects. He holds a degree in economics from the University of Sao Paulo and holds a master's degree in European studies from Hochschule Bremen, Germany. Without further ado, Mr. Puccini. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ed. Thank you, everyone. I would like to thank the Renewable Fuels Association for inviting UNCTAD to present its work here today. My presentation is going to be a bit different from the very deep intelligence insights that we've seen so far, focused on the U.S. I'm going to present a bit of what's going on internationally and why perhaps this global ethanol market matters, especially for poorer countries out there. So UNCTAD, for those of you who don't know, is the UN trade agency based in Geneva, Switzerland. We have an environmental arm where we work with a number of environmental goods, such as ethanol, biofuels, and organic agriculture. So what's going on out there? As we sit here in this room, a number of things are happening in different fora around the world. One of them, and perhaps the big umbrella, is the negotiations taking place in New York on a post-2015 development agenda. The substitution of the Millennium Development Goals, which are expiring this year, for the Sustainable Development Goals, which will guide the 194 countries from 2016 until 2030. And they cover goals in healthcare, education, climate change, and energy. There are also climate change negotiations going on. And 2 weeks ago, I was in Geneva while climate negotiators, including the U.S., were there crafting the hopefully aggressive agreement that we'll have in Paris at the end of this year. We also have negotiations going on for financing for development, which will culminate in Addis Ababa in a conference on middle of this year. And again, WTO trade negotiations. What does this mean for people in this room? WTO trade negotiations include talks on liberalization of environmental goods and services, and some propose reduction in ethanol tariffs to be part of it. So this could be an opportunity opener for people here. And our main conference, UNCTAD 14, in Lima, will take place in next year after these processes conclude in 2015. So a lot of things are on track. What is the relation between biofuels, between ethanol and the SDGs being negotiated in New York? Oh, especially there is one SDG, which is basically a done deal, SDG number 7, which will call for a greater access to renewable energy, sustainable energy, and also more energy efficiency by 2030. And this goal is one of the ones which has the highest political support, so certainly be part of the development framework from next year onwards. And this gives an umbrella for everyone to work together towards promoting renewable and sustainable energy. So what's happening out there? Yeah. What's happening out there? You can find work being done in different fora, different events. For example, the Nairobi framework trying to spread the clean development mechanism, also working to spread low-carbon development to African countries. There's the African Carbon Forum, which takes place every year in Africa. We organize events on bioenergy there with policymakers to assess and promote the responsible development of bioenergy in African countries. Countries as far as Vanuatu, and those of you some island states in the Pacific, are very interested, and we're working with us on developing biofuels based on coconut shells and coconut oil that they have there in abundance. The market today has somehow plateaued, the global market. You see a stabilization level of growth, and I call your attention to a publication that we just launched last year, the State of the Biofuel Markets. There are some copies outside this room on the publication desks, and I can send it to you digitally. You just approach me bilaterally, which says many more things that I can say here in 10 minutes on the state of the global biofuel markets, basically today in 2014, and in comparison to when we started our work in 2006. So a lot of things happen in this period of time, and I think it's worth reading. Developing countries have also adopted ethanol. It's not only a triad between the U.S., Brazil, and the EU. You see countries like Malawi, the Philippines, and Thailand adopting blends. Some are implemented. Others are on track to be implemented. But you see that this interest in this market goes beyond the major economies, the major producers. And I think this is something good. It increases liquidity. It spreads the knowledge and technologies created in places like the U.S., to places where they have a really important development multiplier, like increasing the quality of life of people in those areas. Well, ethanol and biofuels in general can have an important role in other countries, not limited to transportation. It can be used for cooking energy, as many of you know. Can be used for off-grid electrification. In Malawi, for example, 80% of people live off-grid. So just imagine the advantages of having an ethanol fire generator there. And in some of those countries, they are landlocked, so to import diesel to run those generators is very expensive, so biofuels can be very competitive there. And also in aviation sectors. And the EU has a flight path, as they call it. Mexico has it, and many other countries are on track to decarbonize aviation through ethanol. I think the representative from the EU ethanol industry can cover this very well, but there are some issues that need to be worked out in a global partnership for this. One of them is the ups and downs of regulatory uncertainty. Like in 2009, the EU, for example, proposed sustainability requirements, very ambitious, and then the how will I look thing has been highly debated, including the European Parliament. And a proposed solution was to limit the market for first-generation biofuels on 5%, 7%. And this creates uncertainty for investors, especially those who paid to get certified for first-generation production and exports. And partially of this regulatory comes and goes resulted in a small growth of the biofuel markets compared to other renewable energies, such as wind and solar, in the same time frame. What we do at the UN to try to tackle those issues? I mean, we promote dialogue. UNCTAD and the UN in general is not, or most of the UN agencies are not binding negotiation forums, but they allow countries to discuss things, hopefully before they become problems and, for example, go to the WTO. We had an event to discuss the EU proposed caps with the participation from industry representatives. In 2013, we also do studies like the report I just mentioned, and to try to benchmark and have an overview of the market without a centric view on a certain specific country, and look at things that matter a lot for developing countries, such as the costs of sustainability. Everyone wants to have good biofuels, good ethanol, sustainable, certified. But it has a cost, and at least in the EU, you will see no premiums for certified fuel. You either are certified or you don't sell. It's a burden for producers in the US and the EU, but can be a killer for producers in, for example, in Malawi or Sierra Leone. But even then, some examples of successes are taking place. This picture on the screen shows, the factory is already completed, but an ADAX biorefinery, an ethanol mill in Sierra Leone, which is now completed and selling ethanol in the African continent. So there's one of the examples that even countries outside the triad, as I mentioned, can be successful producers in this market. Again, everyone wants to have better biofuels. The industry is very dynamic and is striving to always improve itself. So there's one common thread. Everyone wants to have second-generation advanced fuels. And the approaches to do that have been different. Some give a renewable identification number, the RIN, to segment the market. The EU is now thinking about first initially double counting and triple counting and putting a cap on first generation, all to give traction for second generation. But how can developing countries catch up with these regulatory trends, especially since they are not as competitive, or they're not competitive at all? There's no second generation production in any the least developed country that I know of, continue to participate in this global market. For example, if caps are implemented on first generation, how can developing countries compete on the second generation markets? So while there is some, I think it's a hopeful sign, of convergence between the US and the EU approach in segmenting markets between conventional and advanced biofuels, this change from how biofuels are made, like using sustainability certification, to which biofuels are accepted, advanced biofuels only, can have problems or implications, serious implications for developing countries. So this is why it's important for those things to be discussed. And I think we have EU, US representatives here, Brazilian as well, in order to have some harmonization and include developing countries in this process. So what do we see going forward? We have had demands from developing countries for assistance. For example, Mexico asked us to look at their agricultural sector and find niches for growth, niches for adding value to their agriculture, to the main agricultural products. And this is just a slide that I don't expect you to be able to see it, but it's to show that only with residues from the main crops in Mexico, you can have a high income coming out of that. And you can even replace 10% of the national electricity just using residues, low-value residues from agricultural crops. Another important thing for the future, which is ongoing, is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. As it was mentioned by Jim, it has to be part, biofuels have to be part of these negotiations, perhaps for talks on harmonization of sustainability standards and on technical standards as well to facilitate. It's very important. And I couldn't forget to mention this, to make gasoline sustainable. I mean, the reform of fossil fuel subsidies, which is a topic highly called for in Geneva and other in the OECD, it's more than time to move ahead with the Paris conference going on. So a lot of the future of the future of, biofuel market depends on the fossil fuel subsidy discussions. So to conclude, as we approach the post-2015 era, we have the SDGs putting energy in the forefront of the development agenda. We have continued regulatory efforts to make biofuels better, but we should think on how the different speeds, like in the oil sector and the biofuel sector, they're apparently much more, much higher stringent demands from the biofuel sectors than they are for the oil sectors. And this should be perhaps corrected. And never forget that ethanol, biofuels, have strong human development impacts in areas, especially outside the main production centers, but where production starting to grow and really can transform people's lives. Well, thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer you bilaterally. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and move along, try to keep up with time. Our next panelist, Michael Dwyer, is Director of Global Policy Analysis for the Foreign Agricultural Service, the primary international trade agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Why don't you come on, Mike, and let us know.
All right. Thanks. All right. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
You know, I can't see any of you with these bright lights in my eyes, so I'm assuming you can hear me okay. All right, so Pedro, you did such a great job on your presentation, and Jim, yours too, that I'm going to actually make a bit of a mid-course correction here on what I'm going to say, because I don't want to bore you with redundant statistics. Instead, I'll focus based more on where we're headed instead of where we've been. But I do need to at least start with this first chart. For those of you, 2008 was when I took this job. And biofuels became part of my portfolio as the director of the division. And if you remember what 2008 was known for, that was the beginning of the food versus fuel debate, where American corn ethanol basically got demonized in large chunks of the world as causing the price of food to rise. If I had told you in 2008 the U.S. would become the world's largest net exporter of ethanol in about 6 years' time, most of you would think I was drinking that ethanol, because there was almost no chance. We had a 54-cent a gallon import duty, if you remember back then, and we still imported lots from Brazil. A lot has happened in 5 years. This is a, you may have seen some charts that look a little similar to this, but this has got more of a time dimension to it. This shows where ethanol usage around the world is today versus where USDA believes it will be 10 years from now. One thing I don't want you all to get too upset about, I can see, you know, if Bob's in the audience, he's probably squirming right about now, where we're calling for a 9% contraction in U.S. ethanol consumption by 2024. This assumes no real progress on overcoming the blend wall, that slow growth in E15 and E85. That is not a forecast. It's saying that if current trends continue, this is what things look like. So the job here is to make sure current things don't continue. Our gasoline pool is contracting. The gasoline pool in the number two market, Brazil, is actually continuing to grow. We think there'll be about a 50% increase in Brazil. But the thing you should take away from this chart is there doesn't appear to be a lot of big pies anywhere in the world. If you take the U.S. and Brazil out of the equation, there's a lot of small markets, including in the fastest-growing fuel market in the world, which is Asia. I'm going to come back to that because that's a major theme in terms of market development. A lot of charts will be shown here today looking at U.S. exports. I think that's only part of the puzzle. You really have to look at the larger pond that we play in, and this is global trade in ethanol, looking from 2002 to 2013. You don't have to know a lot about statistics. That's an upward trend, and that's a good thing if you're in the market of ethanol. About 7 billion gallons was traded in 2013. In 2014, preliminary indications are that's about 7.5 billion liters, worth about $5.5, $6 billion. So this is where U.S. exports compete. The beauty of this picture, when you combine it with this chart, our market share this year, at least in 2013, was about 30 to 35%, and that depends on if you use volume or value as your way of measuring market share. In 2014, a steep reduction, in Brazilian exports combined with continued growth in U.S. exports to about $2 billion. U.S. exports, we are the largest exporter in the world with about a 40 to 45% share of the market. Those are great statistics. A lot of that's due to the favorable economics in the U.S. industry, compared with a lot of question marks in Brazil. We think this trend should continue, but not at the rate of increase you saw between 2009 and 2013. This is not U.S. exports or U.S. imports. This is where overall imports of the major producers are. Unfortunately, we had to stop this series at 2013 because 2014 data is not available for a large number of these countries, but it is available for us. We only imported $650 million in 2014. We're not even the world's largest importer anymore, at least this year. That honor would go to Canada. I won't go through all these, but the interesting part of this chart is that the green area represents the level of trade in 2006. That orange area or brown area there you see is the change in trade between 2006 and 2013. A lot of markets have grown, markets that didn't even exist, like the Philippines. Essentially, all that growth has happened in the last few years. And if you combine this chart with this chart, one major piece of information comes out. That brown area you see in the second largest exporter, the United States, which, by the way, were the number one in 2014, is overwhelming. All of our growth has come in the last few years. There's some other exporters have seen growth as well. Rest of world, though, is actually contracted. Less competition from the smaller competitors. So what you've got are booming exports out of the United States compared with lackluster sales out of Brazil, and very few imports by the United States, 650 million, as I said. Pretty favorable picture is emerging. You've seen this chart before. I won't go into a lot of detail here. Good chart, upward trends. These are our top markets. Now, what you should take out of this chart is the entire chart is brown. All the growth in all the major markets we sell to today is essentially a very, very recent phenomenon. And in fact, I think a lot of this story is going to continue for reasons I'll get into in just a minute. Here's that import number. That's a pretty ugly chart. There's no clear trend there other than the last few years imports by the United States have gone down. Here's an interesting point. In the last 5 years, 6 years, the U.S. has gone from the largest net importer of ethanol to the world's largest net exporter. That takes imports and exports into account. The net position nets that the import number out of there. Great story. This one, other than Brazil, we really don't import from anybody. I mean, there is some opportunistic sales, but this chart pretty much says it all. Very, very little imports from anybody other than Brazil. Okay, so where do we go from here? This is the part where I'm going to change a little bit. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. government for that matter, does not consider ethanol technically to be an agricultural product. So when you hear Secretary Vilsack say the U.S. exported $141 billion this year, that doesn't include any ethanol sales at all. It's interesting because if I were to ask anybody in this room, do you consider ethanol an ag product, I'm sure all of you would say yes, especially when you consider DDGs, a major byproduct of the process, production process, is absolutely an agricultural product and one that's been the fastest growing export over the last 10 years. Going forward, the one thing you probably noticed in that slide, and let me just refresh it a little bit, this chart I started off with, the fastest growing fuel market in the world has a very low penetration rate for ethanol. So you have combined growth in fuel combined with a very low penetration, and any market developer would have to conclude this is the market. You at least have to put a large chunk of your resources in if you're trying to develop new markets going forward. The wind is at your back. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy, because the food versus fuel debate still rages in Asia. New talking points are needed, but they're still operating off this. And we mentioned some trade missions that have recently taken place to Asia. If you take a look in Asia, these are the countries in no particular order of importance. It's not alphabetical. It's not size. These are the ones that we believe are probably the ones that would have the biggest payoff. I just came back from Thailand. Thailand, Ministry of Energy, basically said they did not feel they would be in the export market for much longer. Their domestic demand is growing fast enough. They're not likely to have any product to compete with us in Asia, especially when their price of ethanol is almost twice the price of ours. The only way they're going to be selling into Asian markets that we want to compete in is that if they're doing something that helps them become more competitive versus what's at home. And if you're an ethanol producer, why would you export for half the price when you can get twice as much in your own home market protected by the government? I won't go through all of these except the three that have to jump out at you as really needle-moving possibilities are the three biggies: China, India, and Japan. In the case of China, that little red bar you see there, 2012, that's their current consumption of ethanol there, about 600 million gallons. Now, you should know that China does have an alternative fuel to gasoline. It's methanol, and it's blended pretty widely in the fuel supply at least at the national level. The problem is they use coal as the feedstock, which means they're actually better off from an environmental point of view using straight up, you know, gasoline. It's actually worse for the environment than if they just use pure gasoline. If we could convince them to move to an E10 blend, or they convince themselves to move to an E10 blend, that middle chart there shows what their consumption would be. It would be over 2.6 billion gallons a year. And given fuel demand, the projection for fuel demand in China over the next 10 years, 4 billion gallons. So this is a market definitely worth putting a heavy investment into. India, similar story, but on a lower magnitude. And in the case of Japan, same story, but that last bar, 2022, will actually be a little bit smaller than what it would be currently, because Japan shares one feature with the United States and Europe. We have a shrinking gasoline pool. Now, the final thoughts, let me just share something with you. We've been in the market development game at FAS for 50 years. We've got great relationships with a number of the commodity organizations throughout the U.S., including one in particular that's shown an incredible capacity to develop new markets almost out of thin air, and it's the U.S. Grains Council. Now that the USDA has put ethanol on cover for all of our market expansion or our market promotion programs, including one you may have heard of, the Market Access Program, or MAP, and FMD, which are funded under the Farm Bill at full levels, we're going to start developing new markets for ethanol around the world, and we clearly need some. Right now, it's heavily dominated by just a handful of countries. New markets are needed, particularly in Asia. The Grains Council has its partnerships, Growth Energy and RFA. All right. So the strategies that are being put together are not just those by the Grains Council. They're looking to industry partners with a much deeper knowledge of the ethanol market than they do. But I should tell you, you should not discount them, because DDGs as a product didn't even exist just a few years ago. The Grains Council did a tremendous job showing people how to use the product, the kind of results they could expect from blending it into animal feed. I actually think the future for ethanol looks really, really promising. I'm more optimistic than most. I don't know if I'm as optimistic as, I guess it was you, Jim, who thought it could double in 5 years. Yeah, I'd like to think we could double our exports from the current level in 5 years, but I think somewhere between, 25 to 50%, maybe 75% is doable, but it's going to take a concerted effort by the government and by industry working together to turn markets, basically markets that do not exist today or do not exist reliably, as major permanent markets for ethanol. And I think with the industry economics being what they are today and what we expect to be over the next 10 years, where corn will be under $4 a bushel and all the kinds of problems that we see on the sugar side, I think U.S. ethanol will be the ticket for the next 10 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, now we're moving down to our last panelist of the day, at least of this panel. Robert Wright, became Secretary General of ePure in September 2014. He's over 20 years of experience in the European Union public affairs and public policy in Brussels. And I won't spend too much time on his bio. I'll let him get to his remarks. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ed. And thanks, Bob and the RFA, for inviting ePure here this afternoon. Let me see. So it's this one. Yeah, this one. Okay. So I'm Robert Wright. I'm Secretary General of ePure. ePure, as many of you know already, is the European organization which represents just over 90% of the ethanol producers in Europe. We have just around about 50 members, 24 producing members, and the rest made up of associate members from the sector as a whole. So I've come to the US many times over the last few years in previous lives, and very often people have asked what the heck is going on in Europe. So hopefully in the next 10 minutes or so, I'll try and provide some illustration of what actually is going on in Europe at the moment. At this point in time, as many of you know, we face some struggle and some potential very real threats, actually, with regard to the revision of two key pieces of legislation for us. Since 2009, there have been the Renewable Energy Directive, which is the European equivalent of your RFS, and the Fuel Quality Directive, which is our equivalent of your LCFS. These were adopted in 2009 with setting down projections to 2020, and in around about 2011-2012, the Commission decided to start reviewing the both directives to take into account ILUC factors. So we're stuck in the moment in a co-decision-making process in the Parliament with the Council, and we're hoping, and we've been asking, for clarity on a number of issues and for the directives to be reformed and finished sometime around about summer this year, hopefully. Of course, given the vagaries of the EU policy process, there are a number of things that can happen in the meantime to make agreement difficult. The Parliament and the Council of Member States have to agree together, so we're hoping that a deal can be reached, but it's not certain. Four key areas for ePure and our sector in Europe are really with regard to the market cap. You've heard about the cap, which the Commission proposed, capping food-based conventional fuels to 5%. The Council last year proposed 7%. The Parliament has asked for 6%. Our argument is to go along lines with the Council and ask for 7%. And these four key areas, right now, we've managed in the last few weeks to get our key amendments tabled into the Parliament Environment Committee, who vote next week and who, believe it or not, are actually on holiday this week. And back in their home constituencies. So they're hunkering down, trying to reach agreement on which amendments will pass and which will fail. And the four key areas that we've pressed are actually in discussion, so that's a good development. The second area is the 7.5% dedicated mandatory ethanol target in petrol. The third one is actually arguing for a binding target for advanced biofuels. There's some discussion about what the figures of that should be. We want a feasible binding target. We don't believe that the figure itself, the size of the figure, is as important as the fact that it should be binding. But there are discussions at the moment when whether it should be 1.25 or 0.5, and somewhere or another between the Parliament and the Council, there will be some agreement on whether or not to even have it, because the Council and the Member States at the moment are not generally in favour of binding targets on anything. The fourth one, which is a new area, a newish area, and is very, very important, is we've been focusing in the last period of time in trying to get recognition that ethanol in Europe has lower ILUC impacts than diesel. And we're trying to get ourselves into a situation whereby we get that recognised via ILUC certification between now and 2020. So the revision of these two directives are generally seen as creating an awful lot of regulatory uncertainty in Europe, and that is actually the case. Since 2011, 2012, investments have dropped because of this regulatory uncertainty. However, the picture is not necessarily all negative. At the same time that the EU Commission and the EU in general are revising the two directives, RED and FQD, Fuel Quality Directive, there are active discussions ongoing at the moment with regard to developing a 2030 energy and climate framework. We believe that there is a strong role for biofuels to play in that framework, and we believe and will continue to argue that once we get out from underneath this ILUC discussion, we need to start repositioning our industry as being seen as a solution provider and an enabler of the key objectives that will be getting developed inside this 2030 framework. Those two key objectives are so far defined as a minimum 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and an EU-wide renewable energy target of at least 27%. In the Council's own impact assessment, they stated a couple of things which for us seem quite positive and which we can work with at least as a basis. One, that there should be a technology-neutral approach for the promotion of emissions reductions, and also that renewable energy sources and transport should a dedication to renewable energy sources and transport should continue after 2020. There's one little sentence in that which you'll notice with regard to electric transportation. One of the things we're facing at the moment is electrification and electric transport is now seen as very in vogue and very trendy and is getting support inside not just the two directives I talked about previously, but also in the projections towards 2030. Notwithstanding the fact that, of course, many people don't seem to pay too much attention to whether or not the electricity grid will be renewable or not between now and 2030. So there are two key areas, therefore, that I think the biofuels industry has some great potential because it will be needed as a source to actually meet these ambitious greenhouse gas emissions, both in relation to the 27 target and also with regard to the fact that transport is the fastest growing emitter of greenhouse gases in the EU. The estimation itself is that renewable fuels would account or could account for between 12 and 14% of renewables in the transport sector. So we hope and are slightly positive that can we work with the Commission and EU governments to actually promote biofuels as a key part of that mix in enabling those commitments. If we were to actually look at what the opportunities are for European market development and then for also as a part of the larger international pie in terms of global development, as many of you are very much aware, we often talk and fight about who gets what size and what slice of the pie. I think we have an interesting opportunity coming up this year in actually refocusing ourselves and trying to develop the pie as a whole, making it larger internationally. At global level, we have the COP21 meeting at the end of this year. This is very, very crucial in the sense that, again, it will set down an attempt to reach negotiations on a binding, legally binding policy for climate across the world. And I think it's very important for the industry, not just in Europe, but at global level, to position ourselves as being a key part of that solution and that actual commitment to whatever it turns out to be, and we have to be involved in that COP21, in my opinion. At EU level, next week, we have the presentation of the Energy Union Strategy, and that follows on from the previous slide. We're hoping that some of the aspects there of the role of commitments to the renewables and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions will allow us to actually argue for our position. And at member state level, of course, we have rollout of E10, let's put it mildly, some member states have been doing better than others there, and this E10 aspect is very important for us, and it's actually a little bit linked to the request for a 7.5% ethanol target in petrol. Taxation of energy products is probably something that will not happen for a very long time, given the fact that it requires unanimous agreement in the European Union, but it's something that we ask for in terms of fairness. The market development is in a poor state, and we need and we really need to focus on the previous areas of policy in terms of mitigating the threats from revising the RED and the FQD, and maximising the opportunities in the 2030 energy framework to try and solve some of the problems that we're facing here, that we're facing in Europe, with regard to the fact that in 2011 the demand for ethanol was projected as being 14 billion litres. In 2014, it was projected only as being 7 billion litres. So the market conditions in Europe have changed radically. That's a 50% lower amount than it was actually projected. A lot of this is down to the regulatory uncertainty that we've been experiencing in the last 3 to 4 years. Also, we have to deal with the dieselisation of the European car market fleet in Europe, reliance on diesel. And we can see, however, at the same time, there's some counter-reaction to that in members in places like London and Paris, which are now putting much firmer controls on the role of diesel inside cities, given the importance of particulates and pollution in the air. Impact on the market with regard to all of these aspects is that, with regard to some of the statistics shown earlier, there's fierce competition between ethanol producers over market share. There's actually more production than demand, and fuel ethanol prices have fallen 30% in the last 2 years. In regards to trade, last year the EU has exported fuel for the first time to Canada, Dubai and India, and that shows to some extent the nature of the market in Europe. And in 2014, the EU was one of the lowest paying markets in the world. So the imports for both duty-free and duty-paid origin have decreased. So I'll just finish off here with concluding. We need, and some of the people this morning spoke about it as well, certainty. We need stability in regulation. We need the European Union and the European Commission in particular to stop changing its mind on what it needs and what it promotes as being key to its climate change commitments. So with regard to that, we need stable, ambitious targets for renewable ethanol, but before 2020 and post-2020. We also need to see an increased rollout of E10 across the EU for member states to actually follow their commitments in that area. And we need fair taxation of renewable ethanol compared to other renewable and fossil fuel alternatives. One of the other areas that the Commission are doing at the moment, which is promising for us, and we've become part of this alliance in the last 2 months, is a member of the Bio-Based Economy Alliance. The Commission is focusing and trying to focus a lot more on how it actually makes the economy more bio-based. And this is the sort of thing, a regulatory commitment or a policy commitment, that can create an overall principle that can be used and maximised by the industry in Europe to try and get the gains that we I just mentioned earlier. So we can conclude by either thinking the glass is half empty or the glass is half full. Right now it seems rather more half empty than half full, but we're not dead yet. We still have a lot to work on and focus on, and I think actually with some of the international aspects in terms of growing the global market, there are things to be done with UN COP21 this year. So in Europe, it's tough, but we're trying to look forward with a bit more optimism. So thank you for your attention.